All right, well, at this time, it gives me a great pleasure to introduce a really cool dude, somebody I really like and got to know pretty good and from the men's meetings, Anthony.
Hello, my name's Anthony, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 16th, 2017. My sponsor is Lee. My home group is the Thursday night men's stag at the Open Orchid Presbyterian Church on Thursday nights. And I'd like to thank Marcus for asking me to do this. When he did, it felt like I was going to jump off a cliff. Seriously, like I knew I needed to say yes. Like it was my time. I needed to say yes. I needed to grow some more. That was my calling to Alcoholics Anonymous in the past 6 months. It was my last rededication. This was definitely on the list. So thank you, Marcus, for making this happen for me. A lot of things happened before I became an alcoholic, and I don't want to stay too long in there, but I feel like it's important for me to share on these because they stayed with me and helped develop who I was. I was born, that's one, in 81 in Porterville. My mom is 18, my dad is 26, and my brother is 3.5. And life is great. I'm loving life. My brother is here every now and then. We have separate dads. I wouldn't know that for a while. Even though he had red hair and I don't. Anyway, so my dad, I lived with them. It was great. My dad was weird. My mom was cool. My dad had guns and boxes, and there was a cool closet where he would get down underneath in the floorboards and whatnot. But that's all I really knew. I played around. We had an orchard across the street and whatever. But there was a day, like no other, that just changed me. Everything was great. Mom, dad, house, big yard, brother, and a new puppy shows up. Everything's wonderful. And me and my brother go out and play with the puppy. My brother winds up trying to get this dog to sit, and he paralyzes the thing. And then he runs off and he tells my mom. And then my mom believes him and makes me sit in the Firebird all the way to the shelter to have the thing put down. I'm telling her it wasn't me. She's saying it was you, and you have to pay. This would stick with me for the longest time. My dad wasn't good to my mom. There's another thing that stuck with me, and we had to leave. My brother went to his grandmother's house, and I went to my grandmother's house, and my mom went to go find out where we were going to live and exist. And that's when I got introduced to God. I wouldn't know how to utilize God or any of that, but I would become introduced. Every Sunday, we'd spend the entire day going to church. You know, we'd show up Wednesday as well and do another day. And then she had a small group that she would do on Friday. She was very active. She was, my grandmother, she was a Quaker. My mother was raised Quaker, and she like the Quaker Oats guy with the hat and everything. But she was the black sheep. My dad was with Catholic, but he was the black sheep as well. They both drank, but that's not what made me an alcoholic. What made me an alcoholic would happen on later on, you know. We basically moved around until I was about 8 or 7. I can't really remember all of it. And I went to about 9 different schools. I was always a new kid. I was never comfortable. I didn't develop those social skills to just be able to walk up to people and introduce myself and talk to people. I couldn't look people in the eye. I had to sit in the corner, you know, and some things happened. I sat there and I held on to all my resentments, and I held on to all my fears, and I held on to all my angers, and it just kept going. I didn't like life. I didn't like people. So at 8, I decided to kill myself. I tried hanging myself about 12 different times. I left a suicide note on one. My mom found it, decided to give it to her fiance, and he drove me around trying to tell me that you should be grateful for everything. You know, your mom's going to sleep hungry because she wants to give you the last of the food. And just making me feel awful. I held on to all of this stuff, and I watched them drink, and we had barbecues on the weekend. And, you know, all that seriousness would get slumped off, and they would have a good time, and we had a pool table in our garage, and people would come over, and it was a place to be, it was the thing to do. You know, they wouldn't get too rowdy. They'd get rowdy enough. I don't know, it was normal for me. It may be different for other people, but it was fine. It wasn't too bad. I wasn't too upset with them. I'd sip beer every now and then. I knew how to roll cigarettes by the time I was 8 too. Using binder paper. Man, that was harsh. Binder paper and cigarette butts. Like, I was in it. I listened to heavy metal. I was a skater. I had ramps in front of my house. My house was the place to go to if you wanted to get thrashing, man. Like, we did it all. You had to have a signed permission slip from your parents in order to come to my house. A couple people left with broken bones and serious bruises and head injuries, and it was wonderful. We had a great reputation for that. Life was good for a while there, and then we moved again. I lived on Barrington. I just went back and checked this place out to go down this memory lane, and I had a wonderful time. I had wonderful friends and whatnot. You know, I had that problem with suicide though, and I didn't tell anybody. I just wanted to search out the good times, and I listened to heavy metal, like I said. I listened to Alice in Chains and Ozzy Osbourne and Megadeth and Slayer and Anthrax, and I went to sleep listening to Sepultura and all this stuff. And my brother was a speed demon, like, and he was talking to me about Angel Dust and all this other stuff and whatnot. It never brought me into any of all of it. It's like he wanted to tell me about it, but not bring me along, which I respect and understand. But I idolized it, you know. I thought about it. I obsessed over it. I mentioned Alice in Chains. I used to listen to them a lot. Junkhead was my song. And in there, he's asked, what's your drug of choice? And he responds with, what do you got? And that would become one of my little sayings. I'd hold on to it. I thought it was just the coolest thing. Like, whatever, man. I'll do whatever. Because I didn't care. I talked to my older brother, and he said it was like you just didn't care about anything, and I developed a death wish. I didn't care. So one day I'm skating. I have to skate from Grant to Santa Maria High, and it's a long freaking way for a 90-pound guy with all them books on a skateboard to get there, right? And in the 90s it rained too. It was amazing, and then it stopped. So there I am. I cross Donovan. I'm looking at Alvin, and there's this wall of water coming towards me. And I'm like, no, I'm beelining it to my friend's house. I know how to make friends because I'm a skater. I can go anywhere and I can make friends. I just skate with you. What do you do? Let's do this. You know, and I went to his house. He's about, you know, 4 years. He's 21, 22. I'm 15 at this time. And we get to talking, and it's like, you know what? Let's just stay here because I don't want to go to school. Again, wet, cold, shivering. I don't care about what's going on in school anyway. I don't care about life. I can't make friends. I only got a couple friends. Whatever. I'm going to stay here. And he's like, you want to go drink a beer? I'm like, all right, cool. Yeah, let's do that. And just stay here all day? All right. And I went to the store, and I was a kid in a candy store all over again. When I was a younger kid, I used to steal the candy, and I'd get all excited. Oh, what am I going to steal? Get away with it. I like this and this. And then I had that same feeling again, like I'm going to get away with something. I got someone helping me out, and I was like eyeing these cans. I'm like, these cans are little. I want a lot more than that. These cans are huge. My buddy's getting one. I'm like, I don't really want that just yet. And I zeroed in on a Foster's. It was bigger than the other ones. It had more alcohol content than some of them. And I'm right on, I'm going with this. And took that and went back, sat down in a nice, comfy Lazy Boy chair. I had a window behind me, and it was raining. And I cracked open that beer, and I was smoking my cigarette and smoking a bowl, and my buddy's playing a guitar, and there's something on the TV, and I just sat and I relaxed and I let go of all of my fears, worries, doubts, everything. I relaxed, and life was great, and I chased that. That was me. That's where I needed to be. I had arrived, and man, I wanted that. And I did that a couple times, it changed. It just changed. You know, got into when I was 16. You know, I'd been drinking like this for a little bit, and then I was 16. I used to skate over behind Tunnel. There's a nice big wall back there, and we used to sit down and smoke cigarettes. I was already smoking weed by this time. And somebody's like, let's go to a house party. There's a house party down the way. So I went to the house party. My buddy comes in. There's a bottle of tequila right by the door. And we go into the backyard. And they take a sip. He takes a sip. And I take a gulp. Sip, sip, gulp, sip, sip, gulp. And I tried to drink the entire thing. Man, and I have my first blackout at 16. And I wake up on the couch. And they're still there. They didn't ditch me. That was cool. I learned to be appreciative of that. But they were pouring beer on me, you know, all the things that friends do and whatnot. And I was all embarrassed, but whatever. This was life. This was normal. This is drinking. This is what I wanted. This is what I obsessed over for the longest time. And I finally got it, you know. And I'd go to more parties, and I'd become that skater at the party. And there was a couple of us that kind of looked the same, a little ratty and skinny and full of energy. And I'd start a mosh pit in your living room. My buddies would join in, and oh man, it'd be a rager. They usually put the keg in the bathroom in the tub. I don't know why. Like, just get a trash can, but they liked doing that. Later on, people would pass out around it, and like, now I gotta pee past your face. There you go. I love partying. I'd be in the backyard and whatnot. Keg stands, I'd be able to do about 20 seconds worth and then go throw it up and then get back in line so I could do another keg stand. You know, I wanted all the joys of drinking and accolades and whatnot. I'd black out and I'd do some funny stuff. I was a fun guy, you know, and then 17 came around, and so did the harder drugs. I got into acid and crank bad. I don't want to stay too long on it, but they were like my cheat codes for life. Like, I got into crank, and everything slowed down. And I'd work my way up to using needles, and I'd work my way up to doing a teener at a time and going to Magic Mountain and having a blast. And this was my way of just living. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to go out and have fun and do stuff and, you know, experience life. Jimi Hendrix told me, get experienced, and I wanted to. And I was getting out there and doing it, you know. I loved my heroes. I was always alone, and I was always watching MTV growing up. They're in my mind. I got into acid bad, too. This is at 16, 17. Yeah, we're at 17 now. When it all hits the fan. Now, it gets really wild from here. You could probably understand why. And I don't know, remember a lot of it, but it started getting serious. One of my friends drank a handle and walked into a field and died. I can't remember the guy's name. We didn't go by names. We went by surnames and whatnot. So, like, I didn't even know the guy's name. I didn't know his family or anything like that. These are the type of friends we had that I had. Brothers and whatnot, Ride and Die. Ride and Die hadn't come out by then, but you understand. Things got more serious. I ran away at 17. I continued to go to high school. I thought I was going to graduate. I wound up failing foods class, that test that they told me not to miss. I missed it. I was in Pismo getting drunk. One of my favorite things to do was to go to Lucky. It was called Lucky back in the day, that grocery outlet thing on Alvin and Broadway. That was my spot. I could go in, I could take a right, and they had all the liquor on the right side. And I'd go in there, and kid in the candy store again. Just, what am I going to get away with? What am I going to get? And, you know, Povoff or I didn't have Jack Daniels a lot. It didn't poke out just yet. I had a lot of tequila and a lot of vodka. And well, we'd get the vodka and mix it with the orange juice that we'd steal. And but I was good at it. I'd get in and I'd have my bottle and I'd get out, and I did this for the longest time. And for the longest time, it was great, and I was getting away with it. And then one day, I go in there and I try to do my thing, and I try to zip through past the beeper things to get through the door, and they locked the door on me. I bounced off the window. I'm walking in front of all the cashiers, and the guy's like, "Can I help you with that?" He could see, clearly see the bottle in my jacket. And I'm like, "Nope." And I set it down on the conveyor belt, and I leave out the other door. It was unlocked. I never went back for alcohol there. I did go back. They had my picture up. They had a camera shot of me, but my hat was down, so you couldn't see my face. I told my friends about this, but they wanted to go anyway, and they got busted. Yeah, I just seemed to be in the right place at the right time, doing the wrong thing. And my friends would get caught more than I. I wound up at a flap house real quick. This was my house. I lived in a garage. I paid $100, and anybody and everybody could come into my garage. It was great. It was wonderful. I had a pup tent in the back where I'd use my gravity bong, and I'd wake up from a stupor and realize there was a razor going on all the time. So like, I'd wake up and there'd be a party going on. People had already brought in beer to the house, and there's already meat and whatnot, and like, I set it up so where I could drink and all the time. Everybody around me, this is what we did every day. We set out for these things. And I just had some friends that made some weird choices, like, let's let the guy who's sleeping by the telephone behind Chevron, you know, the place where we go to make all our phone calls to get our stuff. We didn't have cell phones, so I used a pay phone. Guy wound up being a DEA agent. I caught on to it, and I told my buddies. And then I left. And they didn't. And they got busted. I was on the streets for a while there after that. I tried a couple jobs, couldn't do anything. And so I landed in the Army. Here we go. I graduated basic training drunk. They gave us like 7 hours and whatnot, and don't get out of uniform, go have fun, be respectful, you're representing the United States Army now. Okay, we got out, we got us some private dancing girls, and then I went and watched Blade 2, and then I ran up a $175 tab at the bar, and tried to dip for the first time, threw up, it was awful. Blacked out, woke up in the barracks, and they had a watch for me. there were people like, they had to look over me. And they were told me that they were going to send me an Article 15 for that. Never got one. Anyway, so I got my blue cord. I'm in the infantry. And they said, "Congratulations, everybody here is going to war. We just had 9/11. Y'all are going to Iraq. Pay attention. Learn. You might be able to save yourself. You might be able to save the guy next to you. Or you'll die. Whatever. It's a machine. We got more people to replace you. But you want to pay attention. It's going to get real." And he was right. I did that training. They sent me to the 101st Airborne, where I got introduced to bars and strip clubs and real drinking. I thought I was a real drinker, and then I met people that could really drink. And I was like, "Oh, wow, I got a lot more studying to do. Oh my gosh." Started doing things like taking 12-ounce shots, chasing it with ketchup. And then I found out they had Everclear over there, and I drink the Everclear. And that's how I spent my downtime. Deployed to Iraq. I don't want to get lost in this. We ground assault convoyed from Kuwait to Iraq. I was one of the lead trucks. We went through a couple minefields. We got IED'd a couple times on the way. Geraldo Rivera was in a helicopter giving away our position, like, for the most of it. And when we got to Anajaf, we went to sleep because we were up for 3 days. We went to sleep under small arms fire. Woke up to it, too. That day, I would watch a tank kill 3 people that were in a tower. And I would shoot at people with my 50 cal, and they would shoot at me with their little BB guns. And my training was better than theirs. I'll spare you the horrors. That's mine to keep and hold on to. I signed up. I'll hold on to that. I don't like talking about it too much. But it's horrific stuff happened, and it stayed with me. Then I went back, and I visited my mom. I gave her some roses, and then I was skateboarding down the street, and my buddy says, I see one of my buddies. He's like, hey, come on, come hang out. So I hung out. I spent 2 weeks in this flop house, tweaker pad, doing our thing. It was this lady's over here. I'm going to point her out. Oh, it's my first wife. I found my first wife there, and it was great. We had a whole love year. I would go back, and she wouldn't even know that I had left, and go back, and she'd fly out, and I'd hide her in the barracks room and whatnot. Went through all kinds of stuff. That's a whole nother story, but about alcoholism, because I'm going to start running out of time here, and I want to get to the message. That year, I can't pull it up, but I got the same Grateful Dead tattoo over here that I do over here. I have one down there, too. I woke up on Bourbon Street with this thing on me. I didn't even remember getting it. It was awful. I got to live with this now. I don't know why I haven't gotten covered up yet. Gosh, it got even worse. So I went back to Iraq. More people died in horrific ways. I would celebrate the death of people now because the enemy was messing this up bad. We were putting body parts and body bags from our soldiers, trying to identify them with tattoos and distinguishing features and whatnot. So I would go by the medic tent where we would have the enemies that we would get. We're bound by Geneva. So these enemies, we'd patch them up as best as we could, and then drug them up and set them up in body bags on the side of the tent, and they'd die. And I would go out of my way to go in front of them and watch them die and celebrate their deaths on the way to the chow hall and then on the way back. It got dark, people. My life disappeared. When I deployed, my wife was pregnant. When I got back, she wasn't. Killed me. That was another thing. I came back and I was no longer a happy drunk. I barricaded her in the house on a blackout for 3 days. I have no idea what's going on, what went on in those days, and I haven't asked what happened. No longer a happy drunk. You cut me off, I cut you down. You don't do what I want, I get you somehow, some way. You know, I got out of the Army, became a disabled veteran. In 2008, we would have a child in 2008. And I was done with life. I couldn't do anything besides drink, besides get addicted to pills. I had to promise that I wasn't going to drink anymore. I needed to promise that I wasn't going to drink anymore. She couldn't stay with me if I continued drinking. And she told me that. And I respected that. And I did my damnedest to stop. But, you know, there I am. She catches me drinking our wedding wine in the garage my daughter's in the garage there. I'm trying to sneak this stuff. Bad things happen. I start losing my teeth. I start using other drugs again and not telling her. I hit it pretty well, I guess, because she didn't know. I told her when I started getting honest in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got really addicted to pills, got really addicted to opiates, and it every day I needed it. I had shakes. I was sick. And I needed this stuff. And I would do anything and everything to not feel like death every single day. I couldn't do anything about it. And I would try to drink. Drinking would help. One night I thought drinking would help. I just need to drink a couple 40s. It'll be all right. And then I tried to stick a nail in my neck. And she wound up saving my life again that night. I wound up going to into the CARES unit, going down to L.A. and getting stuck there with all the other veterans that tried to kill themselves. By this time, I have no teeth. I've checked out of life. I had a doctor's visit, and they were like, "All right, what day of the week is it?" I'm like, "I don't know." Like, "Oh, just pick one." I'm like, "It's Thursday." He's like, "Yeah, you got that wrong." "All right, what month is it?" I'm like, "I don't know. Just pick one." I'm like, "May?" He's like, "No, got that one wrong. What year is it?" I'm like, "I don't know, 2013? "No, no, it's not." And then he told me the date. And I'm like, "Whatever. Okay, yeah, so I don't know the date. It doesn't matter, though, because I don't live. I don't do anything. I don't have to be anywhere. I'm a disabled veteran. Don't you know what I've been through? Everybody knows that I need to drink, and I don't need to remember anything. Every month, I know somebody that's died every month. I need to drink for them, you know? They can't drink anymore. I got to drink their share, you know? I got to drink for the people that aren't here. I got to use. I got to forget, you know? I think that I'm living for them by drinking and whatnot. I don't know any other way of life." It gets bad. We move a bunch of times. The car gets wrecked a bunch of times. Power gets shut off a bunch of times. You know, I can't do the dishes. I can't take out the trash. I don't know what day of the week it is to take out the trash. We have a dog, and the dog run is always full. I can't take care of the dog. You know, my daughter goes to school now, and she's waking me up in the morning. "Hey, Dad, I need to get to school. Will you take me to school?" You know, I'm not the parent. I'm not parenting her. She's helping me get up. My wife was helping all this stuff, and it was a terrible, terrible life. Finally, everything hit the fan, and I needed to go and get better. We needed to get better somehow, some way. You know, people were showing up in our lives, pushing us to get better, strongly. I wound up going to the Champion Center in Lompoc, a rehabilitation center out there. But first I went to the VA, and I walked in there and I said, "I need to get off of opiates. I need help." Finally, I was able to reach out to somebody and ask for help. You know, all that stuff had to happen. All those people had to help me, had to talk to me. So I go to the Champion Center, and the day there, I'd taken a bunch of pills. I was chain smoking joints. I was chain smoking cigarettes between those joints, so that was going on. I didn't have any alcohol that day. I show up, do the intake thing. This is February 15th, 2017. And I do my orientation, and I meet this guy named Brett. And he walks up to me and goes, "Hey, what was your drug of choice?" And, you know, and I wanted to say, "Well, what do you got?" But I knew it wasn't the time or place to say that. So I was like, "Oh, I liked crank. I liked a lot of crank." And then one addict, one alcoholic talking to another, we made a connection. I was having a spiritual experience, and I didn't even know I was, because I attached to this guy. This guy, Brett, if you ever meet him out there, he's got like this glowing secret, a power inside of him. And I've seen it in a couple other people too. But this was my first time actually seeing it. Like, he's got the secrets to the universe in his pocket. And he's just so excited to share it with anybody who wants to ask. And I'm standing in front of him. And And there we would get up in the morning and go for a walk. We would do yoga for an hour. We would have breakfast, and then we would start our classes throughout the day. And then they would take us to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was wonderful. It was a great. It set me up for coming out here, and I had a fear of going back to where I was. So when I got out of rehab, I volunteered back in there. I came here and I found a sponsor. I cornered Kevin G out there, and he became my first sponsor. And that man worked me, helped me walk through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was good in 1 and 2. I needed some 3 and up. He said, okay, memorize the third step prayer. I was going to my 90 meetings. I was doing more than 90 meetings. I was doing almost 20 meetings. It felt like with everything that I was doing in the Champion Center too. So I was doing nothing but recovery. I was, I needed it. I also needed to go do this Tai Chi Ninjutsu thing. That's what they were doing in the Champion Center too, which would come to kind of undermine me. And I should have got to this a lot sooner. Next time I'll strive for this. I do my third step prayer in Waller Park. Get down on my hands and knees with another man and hold hands and say the third step prayer. I offered myself to God. I tell God that I'm offering myself to Him so He can do something with me, so I can do something for other people. And I pray that I do His will always at the end of this, right? In front of God, in front of us, and in front of everybody else that was in that park. And it was magical. And I had to get right into action. Right into action. Right into that fourth step. And I went straight back to that puppy, and I went straight back to my dad and the mom, and I went straight back to the grandmother, and I went through everything. And He made it easy. He said, just focus on this short amount of time, this amount of time, and only put in the name, and only do this, and only do that. Just keep moving. As long as you keep moving, keep pushing, keep doing something. It's hard thinking back to these events. And I'd think back to him, and I'd write it down, and I'd call him up, and I'm like, I feel like crap writing this stuff down. He's like, good, you're doing well. Keep going. I make it through my fifth, and I do my sixth, and I go out on a hike, and I'm like, am I ready to give everything to my Creator? Am I ready to turn over everything? Not really. I don't know. As I understand God, as I understand my higher power, that's what gets me right there. Because I did turn my will over to the care of God, but only as I understood. And I only understood a little bit. So I could only give over my life just that little bit. I would grow more and more and more into understanding my higher power. But I had to have these spiritual experiences. They had to happen. And I had to pursue them in order to get them. But I memorized the third step. I memorized the seventh step mechanically, and I put them into my life, in the morning and at night. I have to switch stuff up to make it actually enjoyable. Otherwise, I feel too mechanical. So I learned a bunch of other prayers as well. I learned the Lord Shepherd, Psalms. I keep forgetting. 23. Thank you very much. We can do it together. And I learned the prayer of Saint Francis, and these open up my eyes. I try to say them as much as I can, Let me understand and to be understood. Let me strive to love rather than to be loved. Let me remember when I forgive that I am forgiven, Oh my gosh. Let me remember that by self-forgetting I find. All these wonderful things. I love the Make Me a Channel of Light piece. It's powerful stuff. And it's that small perception change that makes my life better. If I can just turn just a little bit and not be so aggressive and just understand a little bit, then I can help. I can do something. But if I'm intolerant, if I've set myself up to curse at people when they cut me off and when they're on their phone and not moving as fast as I want them to. If my perception is, man, I need to get my coffee, and they're messing me up. I got to get over there and get my coffee. You know, I'm agitated. I'm not feeling good, and something's wrong. I need to get more spiritual. I need to get closer to my higher power, because I start forgetting that person in front of me might be dealing with death, destruction, loss, betrayal, sadness, poor health. Everybody's dealing with these things. Everybody has to. Death comes for us all, right? And I forget about that when I'm in myself. When I'm just focused on myself, and I need these things. Don't you understand that I need these things? When I was in my addiction, and I couldn't see past myself. I couldn't see past the house. I couldn't see past anything. I was unable to give my all. You know, and that relationship, that first marriage had to dissolve. She stayed with me for the longest time. I don't know why. Oh, but she did, and saved my life many times. I'm forever grateful. AA gave me back my life. And at 3 years, I got 3 years of sobriety, I got remarried. And I kind of stepped away from AA. And I kind of stepped more towards my hobbies and the things that I love in life. All these things that I never thought I was going to be able to do again. I wanted. And I pursued sword school. I pursued this martial arts stuff, and I got some good accolades from there. And I was listening to this guy's teachings, and man, it would probably work for a bunch of other people, but not for an alcoholic like me, because I lost my mind again. You know, I was away from my people. I was away from people that understand that when things go sideways in life, I might go really bad, really fast. And it started to go really bad, really fast. I started hurting myself again, where once I had stopped. I hadn't hurt myself in the longest time. I hadn't put myself in dangerous situations for the longest time. And all of a sudden, I was starting to do it again. I hadn't put a hole in a wall for the longest time. That was like almost a normal occurrence, unfortunately. PTSD's really got me. I get mad quick. I don't want to be places. I can't. That was the other thing that got me stuck. It's like I'm too paranoid to go anywhere. You know, I'm too shaky. I can't do anything. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at the bingo hall or the Freedom Group. I can't remember exactly which one it was in Lompoc. Sweating, shaking. You know, afraid to say anything. And luckily, I had this lady Turtle that was sitting next to me. She said, honey, you don't need to say anything. You just sit right there and you just listen and you just try to relax the whole time. You'll be all right. Comforting little shoulder shrug, and then pay attention. Always pay attention. Listen to other people. That's what started getting me out of my head. I was listening to somebody else and be in their head. And then I don't know, something about that is just magical. This is a magical freaking program, full of transformation and wonder. But you gotta push into it. So I fell off with that. I almost jumped out of a car again, and this was like 7 months ago or so. You know, like, I shouldn't be doing this. What's going on? Well, my spiritual condition was failing. I just recently heard this thing about an escalator, going up the wrong way on an escalator. You have to go pretty fast to kind of get up to the top. Otherwise, you're on the thing for the longest time. And if you stand still, you wind up back where you started. I'm like, man, you can apply that into Alcoholics Anonymous right there. The more you put in, the more you get up. Sometimes slow, sometimes fast. You know, and if you're not doing anything, you're retrograding. You're going back, down and out. I like that, you know. I had to have a rededication, and what I did was after I left my my second wife, and moved in with my mom. I started going to 20 meetings a week. I was sponsor hunting. I knew I needed a guy. I had Kevin in the back of my head, but I'm like, is he at the meetings that I go to? You know? I need somebody that goes to the meetings that I go to. So I started going to all these meetings. And in the Champion Center, three men showed up. Kevin G was the first guy, I think, that went through the doors, this big biker, burly-looking guy. And then right behind him was this big cowboy-looking guy. They're both kind of burly coming in and whatnot. And then behind them is Nate Dogg pulling up the rear. And, you know, they're representing Santa Maria. They came hard. They brought it that night, and I was locked in, you know. And that night, right then and there, I picked my sponsor. I was like, you know, Kevin's going to be my sponsor. And I tracked him down, like I said, and asked him to be my sponsor here. This time was different. I wanted to go to meetings first and find somebody that was in my line. And if it was him, cool. If not, whatever. I just needed somebody. And I was at a stag meeting, and I saw someone buck up to this guy, and I saw Lee just sit there and calmly talk to him, and I'm like, he's got something, you know. He fired back some things that he told me later on that he may or not have said, but I like the way that he conducted himself. And by this time, it's been a couple months, and I'm like, that's my sponsor right there. I'm going to go ask him next week. And I ask him, and he's like, what do you need? And I'm like, 10, 11, and 12, and a lot of help. And because 12 I wasn't doing. That was the other thing. I needed 12. I wasn't working with others. I was afraid of working with others, and I was running away from it. I came back here to the podium participation meeting on Fridays, because I needed to be talking out to people, and I needed to be, you know, I don't know, I figured I needed some newcomers from around here. So I started talking to newcomers, I started giving out my phone number, and lo and behold, I started getting phone calls back, you know, and I started sponsoring. And magic started happening again, this time really fast. You know, I feel it. I feel a part of this whole thing now. Once I was just sitting in the back, just kind of looking around, seeing if, you know, doing the hokey pokey, the AA hokey pokey. And, you know, finally it stuck, and I'm here. And I like being here. I'm going to stay here. Thank you all very much.
Another hand for Anthony. Woo! Good job, bro. Good. Thank you.